Hey, book people! Before today's episode of Hashtag MWriting, I wanted to tell you about something new from our sponsor, Author Accelerator. No matter where you are in your own work, you've probably found yourself working with other writers on theirs. And if that time spent encouraging, editing, and helping someone else turned out to be pure joy for you, you might want to consider becoming a book coach. Author Accelerator provides book coaching to authors like me, but it also needs and trains book coaches. And if that's got your ears perked up, you should head on over to authoraccelerator.com and click on Become a Book Coach.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. I don't remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause, and
I'm going to rustle some papers.
Okay.
Now one, two, three.
I'm KJ Dell'Antonia, and this is Hashtag MWriting. We are the podcast about all things writing. Short things, long things, fictional things, non-fictional things, memoir-y things, which should totally be a word, and as I say, every single week in a variety of different ways, this is the podcast about sitting down and getting your work done.
And I'm Jess Leahy. I'm the author of The Gift of Failure and a forthcoming book on preventing substance abuse in kids that is due in 7 days. And you can find my writing at various places, including The Washington Post and The New York Times.
I'm Serena Bowen, the author of more than 30 romance novels. And you can find me at serenabowen.com.
And I am KJ Dell'Antonia, author of How to Be a Happier Parent and of a novel that will be coming out next summer, and the former editor of the New York Times Motherlode blog. For the most part, at the moment, you can find me sitting in front of my laptop writing a new novel. And I'm going to just own that Serena and I are snuggled up in our small town library, gazing out at... There are a lot of really pretty trees, but these are the ones that we can see are not super spectacular, and that I forgot my microphone, so we might sound a little echoey.
It's just a tiny bit tinnier than usual, but you're fine. And from my perspective, I'm looking out on the woods behind my house, and there are a couple of red leaves out there, but Vermont is just starting to get that orangey glow to it. It's really pretty.
Yeah, we're a little further north than you, so I'd say it's here. It's definitely
well,
here.
What was,
get
what
here
was
quickly,
crazy.
People, if you want to see the leaves.
What was crazy is this week I went from Vermont, where I was wearing a sweatshirt, and I traveled to Charlotte, North Carolina, where it was oppressively hot. It was like 95 degrees. And then I went to New York, where it was cold again, and then back here. So it's just been a really interesting week of summer and getting into fall. So I'm ready for fall. I'm happy about it.
I'm getting happy. It felt like it was sort of blowing up today. Meaning like wind. All right. And now this is the podcast about all things weather, and enough of that. So I'm so excited about our topic today because this is going to be super fun. We're going to talk Enneagrams, which is a rabbit hole that, that Serena went down one day and then quickly texted to me, and I immediately dove right in after her. But let me just say before you all go, wait a minute. We're not talking about our own Enneagrams, although we might. We're talking about using I should actually say what an Enneagram is, actually, before we even say. Anyway, well, we're going to talk about doing it for characters, because it's so cool. But before we do, what is an Enneagram for those of us who don't know, which was actually mostly all of us until we started this?
Right.
You can do the defining.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Well, you have, like, papers sitting in writing in front of you.
The Enneagram, which seems to have had most of its big talk in the 60s with psychiatrists working in psychiatry in the 1960s and 70s, is a framework for explaining various human psychological profiles.
Yeah, it's like
personality
types. Typing. It is not the one where you get IDJHQBY. This is the one where you get a number and
yeah. So there's nine numbers.
Nine numbers, yeah.
In a shape, and So you were referring to the Myers-Briggs system,
right,
of personality typing, which I'm honestly not a huge fan of, partly because it was forced upon me by my corporate overlords in my previous work life. But the Enneagram is, as we'll discuss, uniquely useful for writers, because while both personality type systems have a lot to do with preferences and how you prefer to handle things and how you see the world, the Enneagram, I quickly discovered, is also really focused on character flaws. Like, your superpower is also your greatest weakness.
Right, which is so perfect for creating both main characters and secondary characters. I mean, that's exactly what you need to know. What does this person fear? And what do they want?
Right.
And that's, I mean, that's what these nine types are. And also, I mean, partly because there are nine and then they sort of spread out. There's, like, you know, the enthusiast who leans towards the challenger or leans towards the loyalist. You get, I mean, you get a lot of different, it's, this is not cookie cutter, you know? It's got a lot to it.
Right. And if you get a book about Enneagrams and you take a look, you'll see some discussion of the wings, which is a theory with the Enneagram that each of the nine types also has, like, a secondary type, which is the adjacent number.
And so if we were really good at math and fast, we could tell you how many total, like that.
27, buddy.
That's actually really easy. I thought it would be more. I was thinking, you're right. Okay. I was thinking, no, never mind. You don't have to be good at math for that. Just awake.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I'll take right. it. So the 27 possibilities, but all of which have sort of, you know, a lot of range within them. And happily, you don't have to get a book on this. You can just hit our friend Uncle Google.
Right. And there's some nice, reliable sources for information. And our favorite is the Enneagram Institute.
Yes, definitely.
And I was pointed there. I'd like to give a shout out to author Nana Malone, who is the first person who ever said the word Enneagram to me, and I had to go look it up. And Nana Malone is a romance writer, and now I need to go read everything she's written, because she has a wonderfully nuanced understanding of how this all works for character typing, and she really sort of walked me through how she looks at it, and I was immediately hooked.
Yeah, no, this is, we're both enchanted, in part because, I mean, one of the things that I like about this, besides that it helps you, I mean, we all, I think, as we start with a character, we have this sort of a mental picture that is probably a little, I think we often start from something kind of flat, right? You often start with, like, a stereotype. So you're often like, well, my person is a real type A, or my person is a real, you know, this person that I'm writing about is a real introvert. Like, you kind of just start with one word, and then you build from there. And after you've spent a little time building, then you can dig into these Enneagrams and you'll find the one that fits the person that you're creating. And then you can sort of start reading a little more and go, oh, yeah, totally. So I'm going to just click, we're in the Enneagram Institute right now. We're looking at the peacemaker. So peacemakers are accepting and trusting and stable. And you could see that could be a character, but then, you know, you can go, like, really sort of down into it, and they have a universal temptation to ignore the disturbing aspects of life and seek peace and comfort. They numb out. You can see how you can really use this to create someone.
Right. So everybody's biggest superpower is also their biggest weakness. And even though we like the sound of that as fiction writers, this really shows you how to do it.
Right. I mean, I'm just looking at nine here. It even tells you exactly what it is that nine. So what nine, if you just want to, like, we're not proposing you just grab this and, like, stick it into a book cold. But if you have a character who's a nine, their want is for everything to be peaceful and pleasant. And can't we all just get along? But their need, which is right here on the bottom of the list of description of nine, is to remember that the only way out is through, and you can't just brush your troubles under the carpet. And there you go. I mean, that's practically a plot right there.
It is, and they all are. So
yeah.
Maybe we should just dive in and give a few examples.
Okay, love it.
I'm writing a nine right now.
Mm. I picked at random.
Well, nine is, as you said, the peacemaker or the peaceful mediator. And so most Enneagram resources will tell you, like, what is that person's greatest fear? And nines fear being shut out, and they fear being overlooked. They fear losing connection with others and all kinds of conflict, tension, and discord. So what they're longing for is that their presence really matters.
Mm-hmm.
And their desire is for inner stability and peace of mind because of those basic fears. And so you can see that their weakness then would be to hide from the stuff that isn't quite hitting their peacemaker senses. So you could remain in an idealistic place psychologically and not cope with the things going on around you. And like you said, that's a...
Right. So this person needs to sort of break through that desire to keep everything idealistic and feeling like it's all safe and calm and get to a point where they actually feel secure.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's contrast the nine with a seven. And
perfect, because I'm riding a seven.
Me too.
Oh, excellent.
Well, my seven is a party boy.
My seven is a failed child actress.
Okay. Well, this number is usually called the enthusiast.
Yep.
And their basic desire is to be happy and satisfied, fulfilled, and engaged.
Right.
So sevens hate boredom, and they're easily bored. And I was listening to a podcast with Ian Cron, who has what probably the most popular Enneagram book out there.
Okay.
And it has a bright yellow cover, The Path to Back to You, I think. And he was very clear about how sevens leave a wake of unfinished projects behind them because right. of their attention span, and there's always something more interesting to be doing.
Yeah.
And I really particularly liked his descriptive appeal about all of these. And there's one, I don't think it started like this in the 60s and 70s, but a lot of the writings about Enneagrams now are from a faith-based kind of Christian perspective,
yeah.
which I don't read much faith-based stuff, but he had a really light touch that that made me want to seek out his book anyway, even if the Christian angle is not what's interesting to me about it. But so the seven and the nine don't look at the world the same way, even though they're in the same world together sometimes and have to sort through that. And in each case, you're handed weaknesses.
Right.
And so if you look at the Enneagram Institute site, it will actually tell you what a romantic pairing.
That's right. We can go. We can just look that up right now. Relationships, types. So we've got a seven and a nine here. Mm-hmm. So I'll just go under seven and hit the nine, and we can, what each type brings to the relationship.
Right. They bring a good mix of similar and opposite qualities. Fundamentally, they're both positive outlook types who are optimistic, upbeat, and prefer to avoid conflicts.
There's got to be a but here.
Oh, there's absolutely always a but, and that's why we like
the Enneagram.
So sevens are more active and self-assertive than nines. They tend to take initiatives and to make the plans and have multiple interests, and they bring the fun and sparkle and the party atmosphere. Well, nines bring a sense of steadiness and support, so you can see how that might build.
And that's one of the things sevens want, is somebody to take care of them. They want to feel like they're one seven weakness that I've found that I'm exploiting in my person is that they want to feel like somebody else. They would like to cede the decision making to someone else.
Okay.
So, you know, so that they can just sort of party along, having a good time,
right.
and, you know, getting a chance to try everything and do everything and experience everything, but not necessarily have to make any hard choices.
Okay.
Sevens no likey hard choices.
Oh.
Yeah. So here, potential trouble spots.
Ooh.
Yeah, so here are the potential trouble spots for this possible relationship between the seven and the nine. Sevens are more equipped to talk about whatever's bothering them, But they often feel they cannot help themselves and that honesty demands they tell the nine how unhappy they are with them. That's a good scene.
Yeah.
One of the sunniest and most carefree couples can become one of the most hopelessly tortured if they become unwilling or unable to really talk with each other. Why do I have a feeling that is going to happen to the poor seven and nine?
But that's also like the classic Harry Potter Dumbledore problem, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Just knock on his office door, Harry.
Yeah, that's every book. I mean, it's not a good book unless you're shouting, Just tell them. Just tell people. Just tell everyone what's wrong. Just tell them the truth.
You know what, though? You make a good point because that is in every book, but it's not always good in every book.
No.
So you have to earn it.
Yeah. And it has to be, and it's different in every, like you want, and the person has to have a really good reason for not telling the truth. So you have to understand why they're not going to. And if they don't, if you're sitting there reading along going, oh, come on. Like, you know, the person would just, you know, this character would just, you know, tell her boss everything or whatever, then that's it. You're not going to keep going. So,
right.
So this Enneagrams can help you to find the reasons that your character is not telling.
The deep, dark secret.
Exactly. Is not telling the deep, dark secret, is not revealing everything about themselves or whatever. And then you can also head out and have a little, so one of the things I think is fun about the Enneagram is that it's a great way to find some things about your character that would be true to this person that you have created that are also like quirky.
Okay.
And a funny way to do that, if you just want to sort of wander through the world of quirks of different things, is to, I mean, there's probably a lot of places to do this, but we happen to have found the Instagram account for Enneagram and Coffee.
It's lovely.
It's really funny. So, for example, there's a post here where she says, I need someone who, for each Enneagram type. So, sevens need someone who doesn't stomp on my ideas. And nine needs someone who asks them really good questions and genuinely listen to the answers. Sometimes these are funny, sometimes they're not. But the reason I loved it is you can come up with, like, I have to close that and come on. So you could come up with something that is just like a bizarre quirk that your person always does. So walking down the sidewalk, sevens are dance walking. And you could see you could use that. And what you get is sort of quirks that are going to be consistent with a personality type that maybe you are not. But you know people that are like this. You can feel it. You can sort of get their three-dimensionalness, but maybe it wouldn't occur to them that when they play fantasy football, you know, I was going to use an example that I didn't get to the fantasy football one. Anyway, when they play fantasy football one, they're the one that's always trying to trade.
Right.
Or whatever. That might not occur to you, but it might be perfect for your person. And it's just fun. I mean, you wouldn't.
I liked the fantasy football one too. I read that one. We should do a few more types just because it makes our examples better.
All right.
So type one is the reformer, the moral perfectionist. And I have to say, people, that I think I might be a type one.
So you can, we'll put a link to a quiz you can take that is free. And frankly, the link was chosen entirely because I Googled free Enneagram test and this one was free and kind of long and seemed good. So we'll put a link and you can figure out what your own.
Right.
Or to the extent you want. Because, of course, that's fun. That's the first thing you're going to do, right? But then off you go. All right, so type one, possibly the Serena.
You really like rule following. Like, I don't like to make the rules, but I like to make sure that everyone else is following.
Well, if you're going to follow the rules, then everyone else should have to follow
exactly.
The rules.
Well, exactly.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, no.
Okay.
Been there.
Number two, the helper, the supportive advisor. So the number twos are the people who are making sure that there's somebody working in the soup kitchen on Christmas Eve.
Right.
You know, and they really, really love helping other people, and it really feeds them.
But they also would like to be appreciated.
Yes.
For their doing of this. So I just read I'll talk about this in a later episode because I'm not quite done with it, but I just read The Lager Queen of Minnesota and loved it. And there's a total two. Like, one of the main characters in there is just two. And that's
cool.
They're always doing exactly that, but their inner thought is always, you know, basically maybe when I'm dead, everyone will appreciate how much I did.
Yep. And number three is the achiever. So that's the person in the CEO office burning the midnight oil, you know, making sure he's on top of the heap. And I think, you know, in my earlier life, I was more of a three before I found my inner one.
I might have I could have guessed you into either category. I've got a three in my next book. I've got a broken down, beaten up three.
That's okay.
What I've got in the book I'm writing.
So four is the romantic individualist. So who's the Harry Potter character? Luna Lovejoy?
Oh, Lord, yes. Like, Luna Lovegood. Yes.
Okay. Writing the poetry, gazing at the moon, you know, singing a song, interpretive dance.
Right, right. But there was some fun stuff about that. I remember there was some fun stuff I liked about this one.
What was this? Also, empathy.
They see themselves as uniquely talented, special, one of a kind, but also uniquely disadvantaged or flawed. So you see this in a lot of characters where they're, you know, they feel like they're super special, like they're different from everyone else. And one of the things that they often have to discover, which I'm sure I could find if I sort of scrolled down here, is that, you know, other people also, you know, share their needs or share their interests or are willing to sort of be part of them. I'm just like, my longings can never be fulfilled because I now realize I'm attached to the longing itself and not to the specific result. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, that's what the four needs, is to figure out how to be attached to something besides this sort of dream of themselves as special.
Type five, the investigative thinker, and that's supposed to be the most analytical mm-hmm. personality type. And also tending toward introversion.
Yeah, so it's a little obvious, but if you were writing in the mystery genre, you probably at least would want to hit this so you could figure out whether your person had this or didn't have this. And if your main character doesn't, there's probably someone in your plot that does.
Okay.
I could see that as...
So five is like Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
But Sherlock, exactly, I'm looking at this, so perceptive and innovative, sure, but also secretive and isolated. I mean, that's 1,000 detective story heroes, but they're all interesting and deep and not necessarily, you know, it's not like this is a two-dimensional thing. All right, six, the loyalist. What do you got on the loyalist?
You know, this one I haven't done enough that I understand this one so mm-hmm. well, but it's, sixes know how to be on a team.
Right.
But they're a bit anxious, like they're Woody Allen sort of like mm-hmm. making all of my anxieties, wearing them on the outside.
And the cool thing about this, the Enneagram Institute, so here they are, their key motivations are they want to have security, they want to feel supported by others, to test the attitudes of others towards them, and to fight against their anxieties and insecurities. I mean, once again, I could write, you know, a dozen plots in that. Oh, this one gives George Costanza.
Okay,
so now we know what a six is. A six is George Costanza. Do you like me? Do you really like me? I don't think you like me. I'm just going to be really awful until I see whether or not you like me. But you know, I'm also going to be completely loyal to you at all times. That's okay. That's a six. I like a six. Then I just to keep sort of going with what we can do character-wise here, if you scroll down to the bottom of this extremely useful free site, they talk about how at their best, the six is, you know, self-affirming and trusting of others and independent and, you know, belief in themselves leads to true courage. Okay, that's where your six gets to at the end of your book, right? Mm-hmm. But at the beginning, your six is, let's don't go all the way down to hysterical and seeking to... Well, I guess this is probably where they drop down to.
Yeah, that's the darkest moment.
Mm-hmm. For the darkest moment for the level six, they're self-destructive and suicidal. They're on Skid Row.
Okay, well, that's pretty dark.
That's pretty dark. And, you know, maybe
not in a comedy, maybe.
No. Yeah, maybe in the comedy you only go to level seven.
But you do bring up a good point, which is that Enneagram writers like to talk about what an unhealthy... Mm-hmm. Version of each one of these things looks like. And my friend Nana Malone was saying that she looks at these unhealthiest levels, like what's the worst version of that character's self? And then she sort of looks at that to be the dark moment of her novel.
Right.
And tries to make those things pan out each time.
And it's, I mean, it's really cool reading the stuff about the six. You can see them sort of deteriorating. You know, to compensate for their insecurities, they become sarcastic and belligerent, blaming others for their problems. And then they just sort of keep sinking lower, but then hopefully they come back around and end up believing in themselves and finding their true courage. I'm not sure that ever happened for poor George Costanza.
Yeah, the series ended before he got there.
Yeah, we can hope that he found himself in a prison cell.
The only one we haven't mentioned is number 8.
Okay.
Which,
conveniently enough, number 8 is the one I drop into.
Really?
Yes.
So tell me about 8s, because I don't think I understand this one as
8s well. 8s are challengers. Rebels. Yeah, that would be me. The quirky thing about 8, the thing that kept popping up everywhere, is that 8s also want to try everything. So 8s are ordering everything in the restaurant because they don't want to miss out on everything. So that's an 8 characteristic. Decisive, willful, prefers other people to do what they want. That might be me. I was sort of in between. I was like, am I a 7 or am I 8? But I tested out as an 8. So.
And the fear here is of being controlled, of letting someone else make all the
decisions. And
the
desire is to be in control of their own life, says the, you know, unemployable freelance writer. So that would be me. I didn't spend a ton of time on it, but apparently I could rebuild a city, run a household, wage war, make peace. I've all kinds of things within my Enneagram. But anyway, yeah. So this, I mean, it's just this. It's a rabbit hole. We can't deny it. But man, it's a useful rabbit hole. When you're thinking about your character and trying to create someone who is three-dimensional and whole, who isn't either too perfect or too flawed, you know, to find something that you can... I mean, you can't read this and go, okay, well, I'm just going to apply this willy-nilly. You have to go, well, okay, what would somebody in my character's situation who has these fears, who has these desires, what might they do? You know, what might they have done at some moment in their past that would be affecting what they do now? It's hugely fun.
So it's been really useful for me on the book that I need to finish next, in a couple months or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I have to say that I have discovered a big question in my head about how this all fits together. Because when you use the Enneagram as your character basis... It almost, but not accurately. So here's a moment where once I learn more about it, I'll find my answer. But the other way we build characters is to look at their big emotional wound and to understand how this thing that happened earlier in life is shaping all of their decisions and their outlooks now.
Right.
Which is somewhat in conflict with the idea that you're born seeing the world a certain way.
Yep.
So, I mean, if you want to go with that character background that, he witnessed a horrible accident or, some big thing in his or her past made that person be the way they are right now, there's a little bit of struggle there. And between that framework for making your character arc and this sort of innate diversion.
Yeah, I think that when it comes to creating character, I could probably work with either way. You need to have the emotional wound or the moment in their background or the lengthy experience. You get a lot of options there. It doesn't have to be a single event that gives them the whatever misbelief is that they're sort of traveling through life with, right? But I feel like I personally can take the Enneagram and either start it there. It doesn't bother me. I'm cool.
Okay.
They don't have to have been born with it.
Right.
Or maybe I could... I find that I can't make a person... The minute I start to make a person and I want to give the person a name, I have to know who their parents are. And sometimes even who their parents are.
Okay.
Not in depth.
Right.
But I can't even name you unless I know what your mother and father would have named you.
Okay. Well, that's really healthy as a fiction writer because you will save yourself time, I think, because I actually kind of take the opposite approach, whereas that I usually know some dramatic thing that's going to happen at the 50% point. And so the beginning part of my characterization sounds like I'm holding a Barbie doll and a Ken doll, one in each hand. And the dialogue that's coming is like just as bad as it sounds like it would be. And I have to sort of bumble through that for a while until I figure out what they're really saying to each other. So if I knew who their parents and grandparents were, I think it would, you know, the first draft of chapter one would be a lot better.
Maybe. And sometimes you get, like, you know, lots and lots of pages on who their parents and grandparents are that you really, really don't need. But yeah, I can't even give them a name until I know where that, you know, where the name would have come from. And then to know that, sometimes I have to know, like, why the parents' names were what they were. I guess I think names are really important. I could probably find a naming rabbit hole. Oh, God. I have found them. I have found them all.
I've bought baby books when my kids were already teenagers just for this purpose. Seriously. Yeah. There's a lot of baby books in the world.
No. I just Google, you know, good common surnames for, or common first names for people with X descent and that kind of thing.
And I'm sure you've discovered the Social Security naming database.
Oh, goodness, yes. Goodness, yes.
So in case our listeners don't know, this U.S. Social Security database publishes the most popular 100 names for girls or boys for every birth year, going back a goodly amount.
Right, which is great because, you know, if you need to bring somebody's grandmother or great aunt into the story, you don't want to name them Madison.
Right.
That'd be wrong.
Right.
Pro tip.
So you would go back and you would look at the database for the year of 1939 and see that Sally was the number 17.
Or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. This is like, character creation is so fun. I feel like I could just create characters all day, but darn it, then they have to go and do something, and I have to be mean and make terrible things happen to them, and I have to have them make terrible choices. And that is where The glorious thing about this Enneagram is that, man, does it give you the reasons that your characters make really, really, really terrible choices.
Yep.
Yeah. And, you know, contrary recently, to all appearances, Jess is still here.
I'm still here. No, I was going to say recently I'd noticed Serena posting things to her Serenadipity Facebook group that she's been doing mean things to characters lately. And I've been wondering about what kind of evil stuff's been going on over in Serena's writing world.
You got to do mean things.
Absolutely.
I think I put it up somewhere. Woke up, did mean things to character. I don't remember what it was.
I feel like I haven't always been very good at that.
Yeah, it's a weakness of mine, too. I'm like, why don't they just make all the great choices? And the whole book will just be the happy middle.
Yeah. Well, plus, honestly, I let readers' angst into my head. Like,
right.
I'm writing a book about two characters that my readers have already met, and I know that they're not going to want me to make him make bad choices.
Mm.
Like, I can already hear, you know, there go, you know,
yes.
don't make him do that.
Yeah.
And those voices are kind of hard to shut off sometimes.
Yeah, I have to just have the voice that's like, oh, you know, that's just too hard. That's too much. That's too awful. Nobody wants to read about that, but... Yeah, we do. We absolutely do. That's exactly what we want to read about. And speaking about what we want to read about, should we talk about what we have been reading about?
Absolutely.
All right.
Who's going first?
Well, you go first because we haven't heard from you for a while.
Okay. So this is because I've been traveling this week and I've been doing a lot of audiobook listening. And I listened to some really interesting things. I also want to talk about the fact that Renee Denfeld's book, The Butterfly Girl, came out this past week. She also published, I know I've talked about her before. She wrote The Enchanted. She wrote The Child Finder. And The Butterfly Girl is the next book in a sequence with the same protagonist that was in The Child Finder. But what's so interesting about Renee is that she's just decided, I have never seen her do this before, she just wrote something memoir-y for crimereads.com. It was an essay called The Green River Killer and Me, because Renee was a child runaway, a teen runaway. She lived on the streets. She grew up in a very unsafe situation. And so the stuff that she writes about, these kids on the streets that get lost and sort of lost in the system and lost in the world, she's lived that. And so it was really fascinating. I've been so engrossed in Renee Denfeld's fiction to suddenly read this piece of memoir from her. It was such a gift, and it's a beautiful piece of writing. Crimereads.com, The Green River Killer, and me. But then I have something really fun. I read, I decided to do something a little bit light for this trip. And so I listened to Demi Moore's memoir called Inside Out. And you know when there are those memoirs where you feel like you're hearing a little too much. Like,
yes.
I don't think I should be hearing this. Like, she spills everything, and I got a little uncomfortable. And it was also really weird because I read it right after it came out, which is when they were looking for like Ashton Kutcher for his response to what she accuses him of in the book. And so in real time, I could like see on Twitter how people were responding to this book. But she really, like, if you're looking for a juicy, you know, sort of scoopy memoir, this is the one for you. And, you know, I also didn't realize she'd been through some of the stuff that she's been through, but it also made me a little uncomfortable. It was really,
the best memoirs walk that line, and the other ones slide a little bit in either direction, which doesn't make them not necessarily good reads.
Well, there were moments where I was like, oh, this is probably best for the therapist, not me and the entire world.
That's the problem with being Demi Moore, is that nobody stops you. Nobody says,
You know,
your editor is like, hey, maybe this part, let's just, why don't you sit on this part for a little while and we'll come back to it. You know, whereas her editor is like, oh, Demi, it's great, because she's Demi Moore.
Well, and she worked with a ghost, and I believe it was with Harper. So that's the kind of conversation I would love to be a fly on the wall for. You know, as much as I loved, you know, what I heard from about investigative reporting in She Said with Megan Toohey and Jodi Kantor, and I got to see all that behind the scenes stuff. What I want is like a behind the scenes. Here's what it's like when a celebrity and a ghost writer sit down and work on something together. I would love to be a fly on the wall.
Yes,
for that. I think it would be fascinating.
Me too. Agreed. Yeah. We have to find that person. Yep. If you're out there, we'll interview you completely anonymously. We promise. So I have a question for you. If you're traveling and you're listening to this memoir, what are you doing while you listen? Are you walking through the airport?
Oh, yeah, I'm walking through the airport. I'm in the car on the way to the hotel. I don't sleep very well when I travel in hotels. So
I just wanted to picture you. I don't know why.
Yeah, no, I'm trying to catch up on sleep a lot. So often on the air, I have noise canceling headphones on the airplane. And if I'm too tired to work, then I just listen to a book. I take a lot of walks when I'm traveling, because I've been sitting on planes so much, and then I'm listening. So yeah, I do a lot of listening when I'm just sort of going from place to place.
Cool. Yeah, that's a lot of listening, because that's a lot of hours.
Well, and, you know, things like before I go on stage, you know, I have to do the whole getting ready, and I do makeup, which is something I don't normally do, and I do my hair, and during all of that, I'm listening. So there's a lot more listening that goes on when I'm
perfect.
On the road.
That makes total sense. Yeah, I just like to picture you. I think your life traveling around speaking is as interesting to some of the rest of us as, you know, this idea of the ghostwriter sitting and talking to Demi Moore. It's just different. So details.
What's also fun about the audiobook thing for me when I'm at home is, like, if I'm vacuuming, then I use my noise canceling headphones when I vacuum so that I can hear the book. Or if I'm out working in the woods, then I just have little earbuds in. So I'm almost always listening to a book if I'm doing like housework or yard work, that kind of thing too.
Right.
So. Anyway.
You, me?
I am reading The Chase by Elle Kennedy, which is her new one. And Elle Kennedy is one of my collaborators, and she is just super fun, super great dialogue, good time. She writes these romance series that take place in college, but they're never in a bubble world. Like, there's a real, you know, world with grumpy coaches and goofy teammates, and it's just a good time.
That's fun. I like it. Yeah. That's what I need. Well, I want to concede that the book that I read this week was actually a little unlike me. And oddly, this is a good time. So I finally read The Great Believers by Rebecca Mackay. It was a big book last year, and it just came out in paperback. I love the cover. And this is... So I've heard... I actually met Rebecca at a book festival, but more relevantly, I've heard her on a couple of podcasts. And what's interesting about The Great Believers is a book about... the 80s AIDS epidemic, as well as having a part that happens in either 2016 or 2017. It's kind of relevant which, because it's historical fiction that you don't think of as historical fiction. If I say historical fiction to you, you're like, oh, bodice rippers, you know, people riding horses, prairies, stagecoaches, whatever. But this is as much historical fiction as that, because she took, you know, Chicago, where the AIDS epidemic hit hard, and put her characters into the world of everything that was happening right then. And it's really well done. But even more importantly for me, it's actually a super positive, hopeful read in which the people in it are joyful, real-seeming people having happy lives, often up to the point when they're not, because, you know, AIDS. Mm-hmm. But it's not... I read another book that was in the literary fiction category this past couple of weeks, and I ended up sort of hate reading it, because I could follow, like, I got why the story was getting everybody's attention, and I got what it was about it that made it sort of good literary fiction, but I really hated the people, all of them. I just wanted to throw all of the, you would not want to be in a room with anyone who had been in that book. And this one is not, you know, The Great Believers is not like that. You would want to be in the room with everyone in it. And yet, it's this really, you know, deep emotional story. So anyway, highly recommend. Not that other people have not already recommended it, but this one's, it's a good one.
Cool.
Tim just finished it too, so you and Tim can talk about that
we
one sometime.
We can talk
he really,
about
it. He liked it too.
Yeah.
So to, as an HIV doc, it was one that had been recommended to him about 15 times. So
I am not in any way an HIV doc. Or, yeah, so let me, I don't want to, like, don't be scared off. You don't have to be an HIV doc to enjoy this book. But, yeah, that is what he does. So that doesn't surprise me. But it's just yeah. A good book. I can see why, you know, it was top 20 for a lot of people in the year that it came out. It's really excellent. Yep.
Am I doing a book?
Oh,
do I get to do a bookstore?
You get to do the bookstore.
I get to do a bookstore that the people were so kind. They were the booksellers at one of my events. I was recently in Illinois, and Prairie Path Books came out and did my book sales for me. And they were just really great. We got talking about, you know, other kinds of books that they carry. And the bookseller was making recommendations to me. And I'm just always so grateful when a bookseller comes out and works at one of my events and sells books for me. And they're always just excited to meet the authors and talk to them about their books, and I'm always grateful. So I wanted to give Prairie Path Books in Wheaton, Illinois, a shout out.
Excellent. Well,
yep.
We love them all the indies.
We do.
All the bookstores.
We
I want all the
all.
Books. I want all the bookstores. All right. Well, before we shut ourselves down, a reminder that we've got our new thing. You can sign up for our weekly emails. And every week when we drop a new podcast, we'll send you an email with a little something about what the episode is about. Sorry. You can click and listen right there, although you can, as always, listen in your podcast app. And you can also click through and find a transcript along with all of the show notes. You don't have to click through for the show notes. That's a little confused. But all the links, everything you might need to know for an episode is in the email. And we are also inviting everybody to support us. So, you know, if you love the podcast, if we're doing something for you, if we've helped you out in your writing at all, and you want to take a little time to head into our website and give us some financial support, we'd love it. And we're going to offer, yeah, I'm really rambling because this is hard. It's weird. It's weird to do this, everybody. let me just lay it out. But we created this really great thing that we love called the Writer's Top Fives. And if you're a supporter of the podcast, then every week you get a top five. And we have done top five questions you should ask your character. We've done top five reasons you should be on Instagram, top five things you're going to get out of NaNoWriMo. There's a lot of We had a good time with it.
And we have so many coming up.
So many coming up, and they are great. And I just totally ran out of steam on my promotion there. That's okay.
I wanted to mention to you guys that we got a lovely note from one of our listeners who actually has hearing issues. She's not completely deaf, but partially deaf, and she wanted to thank us for our transcripts. She said it's been really nice to be able to go back and look at the transcripts and see what she missed.
Well, that's wonderful. And we've also been seeing in the Facebook group people saying, where are the show notes for episode 10? And so it's lovely to know that people are going back and looking at the show notes, that they're not sort of just sitting there in some sort of metaphorical bottom of a canary cage on the internet. So I love that. Please go look for our show notes.
All right. Well, until next week, everyone. And by the way, when we come back next week, I will either be done with my book or deceased.
Or weeping under a sofa somewhere. Yeah. No, you will be done. Exactly. You will be done.
I will be done. Until next week, everyone. Keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game. This episode of Hashtag MWriting with Jess and KJ was produced by Andrew Perella. Our music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and performed by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their services because everyone, even creatives, should be paid for their work.
Thank you.